it seemed that this was really a propitious moment to invite Lauren to join us here tonight and to extend that conversation before the public. So now I'd like to introduce to you our President and CEO, Larry Richard.
Thank you. Thank you, Jordan. And thank you, Skirball staff. You make these things happen. And I appreciate the effort, as everyone does, who's here tonight. Among those here tonight are members of the board of the Skirball Center, and they include Howard Friedman, our chairman, Art Bilger, Lloyd Coatson and his wife, Margaret, Peter Weil, Harold Williams, who sent me an email in return to mine when I said, I really showed off, and I said, members of the Board of Trustees, I have known Warren Bennis for 40 years. And Harold returns and he said, and I beat you by several years because I tried to recruit him to UCLA. I think it was the mid-60s, was it, Harold? And so you've got 15 years on me. Harold, of course, is the founder of the game, and so it's growth to maturation. Marvin Zeidler and his wife, Judy, and I also, when I came in, I saw another friend, I saw many friends, among them the former chief of police of this city and currently and has been council member for many years, and that's Bernard Parson and his wife, Bob. So, welcome to a conversation with one of America's foremost authorities on leadership. Warren began his illustrious career in December 1944 at the age of 19 as the youngest officer in the United States Army's European Theater of Operations in World War II. He is today a distinguished professor of business administration at the University of Southern California. He is chairman of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard University's Kennedy School. And yes, Jordan, he's written many books. They number 30. 30 books, this memoir being his, I believe, his 30th. And he's just told me that he's working on his 31st. Prior to coming to Los Angeles and USC in 1980, he served as provost of SUNY Buffalo and as president of the University of Cincinnati. I first met Warren in 1971 when he became the president of the University of Cincinnati, and I was a newly minted rabbi at the Hebrew Union College, which was located just across the street from the university, diagonally so. And I had just been appointed the dean of admissions of the college. And about a month or two, Warren, into your presidency, I called you, and it was a cold call. It's in the chutzpah department. And I invited you to come over to Hebrew Union College. And to my surprise, he actually took the phone call and he welcomed the invitation. I thank you throughout the years, and I thank you again tonight for your kindness and the generosity of spirit in answering this punk rabbi's call. The 20th century has created many philosophers, among them Martin Buber, who knows again and again that all real living is meeting. All Our lives are compilations of whom we've met along the journey. Warren's insightful memoir entitled Still Surprised, A Memoir of a Life in Leadership, is all about the story of your meetings. I feel privileged for being among those who met you 40 years ago. Our friendship deepened in 1980, when we both arrived in Los Angeles. I first introduced Warren to the concept of the Skirball Cultural Center in the mid-80s. In the early 1990s, I invited his bride, Dr. Grace Gabe, to visit with me and my wife, Mina, in the trailers during the early construction phase. I should note that I had just officiated at their wedding. I shared with Warren and Grace the evolving mission statement and showed him and Grace the architectural model. Quote, Warren's response, "One day I would like to think of the Skirball as my second home." So I welcome you to your second home. Before Mina and I left on an extended African safari several weeks ago, I emailed Warren and asked him if there were any questions he would like me to ask during this interview. His answer was absolutely no. I prefer to be surprised. I certainly hope to do so this evening. So let's see if we can throw in a couple of questions that might indeed usher a surprise. And I would like to begin doing so now, letting you know that we will have a Q&A for about 15 minutes after I have no more questions to ask. I also want to note now, this is important, that when you leave, there will be the closure of the exit of Skirball Center Drive, so that you will need, if you're heading south, go on Sepulveda and get on the freeway at Getty Center Drive. And if you're heading north, the exit would be, it would be Valley Vista. Okay, I thank you for coming here and for spending this time with us. Okay, my first question of you, Warren, is what in the world compelled you to write a memoir?
Before I answer that, Tori, can I just say something about being here with you tonight? I'd like to. Actually, I'm going to put my notes out just for a minute. And also, thank you all for coming to great treat when people turn out. But I was thinking, as you were introducing me, that only in Los Angeles was as part of the introduction giving directions about what freeway. Marvelous. But the word that comes to my mind actually is thought. Because being here tonight with you, being with Uri and Mina and seeing Grace, our relationship over the years has been fraught with important times. I remember before that, when you called me in 1971, I think it was to speak to the faculty at Hebrew Union, and I said yes to it. And I think you came over to see me before, I think to make certain that my degree of Jewishness had not been too much strained, because you wanted to make sure I understood Hanukkah was up soon to come, in order to make sure I knew about that, and to make sure that I wasn't going to make a fool of myself, and that I was appropriately responsive to 9-1. That you were wanting me, I think you were worried that I would pronounce it Chinooka or something. Very polite to come over and reach me, isn't it true?
That is true.
Then it's fraught also with the notion that in 1992, married Grace and me, and there were only the two hosts, the two verses, you and Maya, and Grace and me, and it was another lovely occasion. And you've always been there, I must tell you, when I, in very important, not so pleasant situations as marrying, but when I wasn't well, and you guided me to get the best health care I could. And I think, although I cannot see them, I just want to, first of all, it's an emotional, more than usual for me to be here tonight. And now I just want to say that, thank you. You've been a buddy and a friend. As a matter of fact, I must say one other thing. But what I was thinking about tonight, and our relationship, I was thinking of a word that has always interested me. And I remember it because there was somebody's biography that was called this word. It's a word you almost don't want to use because you think you have to explain it. Because first of all, it's a complicated word. The origin is early Greek. I looked it up on OED tonight. The word is palimpsest. And that word may be familiar to everybody here. I don't think it's a very used word. I know there are some people who get it immediately. I see them smiling at that. Selma and Fred, thank you. Palimpsest is a very interesting word because it means that the early paper, as you know, was not regular paper. What was it called?
Papyrus.
Good. Thank you. And it was about people not quite effacing the original writing, but over centuries and years of time, it was deeply intentional. And it's a word that makes me think about our relationship. Palimpsest. So many layers, so many experiences, so many painting over and rewriting and re-engraving. But down there, there's a deep archaeological almost connection. It's a marvelous word, palimpsest. It was the title of a writer's autobiography. The reason I wanted to write, to get to your question now, the reason I wanted to do a book this way was I wanted to use some key life experiences that I thought would bring out in an indirect way some lessons about leadership. But the subtitle, I'm still surprised, is we can talk about the subtitle. I mean, you have some issues with it, and I won't be reasonable. But the subtitle is a memoir of leadership. And if you think about the outline of the book, it starts with chapter one is about, it's called the Crucible of War, and the last chapter is the Crucible of Age. That's sort of the bookends of the book. And when my colleague Bob Thomas and I wrote a book about leaders 70 years and older and leaders 30 years and younger, we call it Geeks and Geezers. I thought it was very accurate, uncharacteristic stuff. And the book said, no. So they wanted to call it Leading for a Lifetime. Which I thought, what's the word I want to use? It's a nice Yiddish word. Schwach. I thought it was so empty. I thought Keith and Coos would blame me up in a ride because it didn't sell very well. But in the course of interviewing people, they all had what was fascinating was crucibles. that they defined. They didn't use that word, but it was, it isn't just one. That's the interesting thing. It's there, those moments. So I'm going to use some of my personal periods to reflect and to bring out indirectly, not in your face. Address an issue which has preoccupied me since I've been 7 or 8. What is it about leadership? What is it that I think having older twin brothers who are so different was part of this, because one of them seemed, they were identical, but one seemed to have that indefinable, ineffable way that what he suggested I would automatically want to follow. And whereas the other would say maybe the same thing, let's go to movies, I would feel it was like no energy. It was like an acoustical dead space. Or this twin, I'd say the same thing, and I would go, what is this? So we started, I think we all wonder about, if we all grow in family, and then it's our first authority structure. So mother and father in a relationship. If we have siblings, we learn about cooperativeness and cooperation. I think the early lessons are born in us before we really know it. And we are all acute observers, I believe, of leadership and followership. And because when I think about the dozens and dozens of definitions of leadership in the, let's call it for the moment, a canon of studies over the years about leadership, but the single thing that stands out, the only way I know how to define leadership, is that I have inspired followers. Now that, by the way, is absent from moral or ethical basis. And that's another issue that I'm more and more.
I plan to bring that.
I think that's why I also did it, because I wanted to see what I would learn. It's basically ridiculous to you all listening, but I would urge everybody here, and that's going to sound fanciful, and you probably won't do it anyway, so. But I think writing a memoir is a very good exercise. Maybe every 3 years, why not? Since I finished it, which was middle of March this year, I'm now more curious about things that I didn't address. So the reason was partly so. Mainly, what could I learn, what could I knew about leadership to reflect on my own experiences, and indirectly, not academically, but intellectually, basically out of experience, because that's my teacher, his experience. It's dialogue.
So are we to expect another memoir in 3 years?
Was that anything?
I said, are we to expect another memoir in 3 years?
Look, the first book I wrote was in 1961, and I thought, good not say that it had any false modesty, by the way. At least I don't think so. I think it's really true. The idea that you're going to sentence yourself in your own sentences, that you have the audacity to think what you have to say is interesting. I don't know, memoir yet? No, I won't.
You just recommended it to the audience, but not to yourself. I appreciate that. Next question. In your book, you make mention of reinventing yourself and perhaps the need for leaders to reinvent themselves as well. And the question is, why is there a need to reinvent yourself? Is that really possible? And could you give us some examples of both the benefits of reinvention and what are the costs in doing so?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
job and getting to know a new community. And I think, I guess being a intern, the only way I really learn is through experience. Maybe that's why I made so much of it, and still will. And that's why the last chapter is dealing with, hey, what it means. Before I came, I looked up a quote I wanted to use tonight, and I think I wanted to write it down because it was a man who was known, it was Oliver Wendell Holmes, who probably served on the Supreme Court as long as anybody else, but was probably the most quotable justice we've ever had. And where is it? Oh yeah, he said, by the way, he was born in 1841, Oliver Wendell Jr., and 1841 died in 1935, served in the Supreme Court. I thought it was longer than 30 years, but when I tonight Googled him, it was only 30. But he said this, a person is always startled when he hears himself seriously called an old man for the first time. Well, think about saying that to yourself, I'm an old man. Now, it doesn't mean, even the I overheard some couple of students talking about me long ago. It was very positive, but I never heard this when I was 50 or 60, maybe even 70. But you know what they said? They just heard me talk, I overheard them, they said, boy, sharp as a spry. Still spry. Those are the words that you don't get. And then no one says you're an old man, but and I say that with a kind of a pride too. The pain is a recent addition to my life. It also defines me too. So I think we're always reinventing. I think the reason why I think it's a good thing to be conscious of it is because if we just stumble into it and wonder what the hell's happening to us, how marvelous to be able to at least recognize those things.
I said, you should have steps in your life that do not are not in need of reinvention.
I'm sorry.
First, let me ask, can everyone hear in the bathroom?
You might have a hearing issue.
Yeah. You cannot hear?
Sorry,
wait. No.
Can you be louder?
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I want everyone to hear your words. My question was, are there any aspects in one's life that are not in need of reinvention?
That are not in need of I think the way I put it earlier was, I think it would be, one should not be overly self-conscious, but be more than who they are. I tend not to want to talk about necessarily needlessly bring up age or something like that. So I think to be overly self-conscious, I think would reduce the degree of the realness and the authenticity. You just can't all the time be thinking about, what I'm going through. It's sort of an adolescent kind of thing. I think there are a lot of things we go through that we can call them green to passage, passages. I just have a deep belief that what's happening to us at the very micro level of our relationships with family, and at the macro level of what's going on in the world. I think the more aware we are, the better off we all are. I mean, that's my deep, deep metaphysical bias.
You give a lot of, you express a lot of qualities that leaders need to have. And I wonder if we would need to look at the word leader and look at history, and in this case, Jewish history, and the term that expresses leadership in Hebrew. In other words, long before you dealt with the field of leadership, leadership existed in the biblical text, in the pre-biblical text. And I found it interesting that the word in Hebrew for leader, which is still the word given to the presidency of the state of Israel, is the word nasi, the word nasi, which means the one who carries the weight of his people and the role that the leader has is to lighten the weight. And I wondered what you thought or made of the Hebrew definition of leader.
You know, I'm all now doubly glad that I did not want to know the questions before. First of all, that's a beautiful, beautiful way of putting it. Because when my first sort of is that better back there? Yeah, good, thank you. Okay, boy, I have never heard that, but it's so interesting about the connotation of words. I wrote it, there's a book that that was published in 1985, and it was really the first book that was called a trade book, meaning it had some possible potential public interest, you know, would be reviewed national press and so on. It was called Leaders. When that book, Leaders, was published in Germany, it was translated into a number of different languages. And you know what was interesting is that the language was really in Italy. The Italian had Duce in the title, and Germany, Führer. And it made me wonder, so that definition in Hebrew, I have to see it actually. How is it spelled?
N-A-S-I. Transliterated. N-A-S-I.
Yeah. I want you to repeat it because it sounds, I got the gist, but I want you to repeat it before me about the definition, about the weight.
It means the one who carries the weight of his people and attempts to lighten it.
Well, that's, I wish that were true all over the world. To tend to lighten it, to understand the weight, their worries, their concerns, and tend to lighten it. Ooh. That's gorgeous. I've never heard anything close to that, you know. It's strange spelling. I was wondering about that because it's so close.
It's a transliteration.
I said, okay. Yeah. Because it reminded me too much of Nazi. You know, it's just one letter. It was a different, totally different meaning. I have two living military heroes. One is a man named Eric Shinseki. S-H-I-N-S-E-K-I. And the other is Bolton, now retired. And now he's head of the Veteran Affairs. He's a cabinet officer in our current administration.
I think it's a perfect role for him, chief of the Department of Veteran Affairs. He was a four-star general. He was forced out of office because he told the truth. He committed candor. And it's now being now accepted as true. He was saying, of course, because he's a good military man. And by the way, he's Hawaiian-born Japanese. And forced out because he was forced, I was told this by Schumer, to respond to a question of the Senate, and he refused to. He said, you must talk to Mr. Rumsfeld, the secretary. I don't feel I'm at liberty here in my role. But, and Schumer apparently brought out the Constitution, said something in the, I don't understand, something in the Constitution that forced him to say, do you think we have adequate troops in Iraq? And Shinseki, ladies and gentlemen, was forced to tell the truth, or his truth, which was, we need at least another 200,000 troops if we're serious, since the invasion, said that. And he was shortly thereafter eviscerated in an empire. Eviscerated meaning that Rumsfeld began, get this, talking to his number two, man. And then finally was resigned. A great man. And the other one, we don't usually, is a former admiral named Thad Allen, who was the man, Coast Guard, head of the Coast Guard. Remember the name? Probably not, but he was the hero of Katrina. He came in there, and even though a military man, he was just interviewed, and I read the interview, and he said, the military does have a chain of command, but if you're faced with a crisis, the chain of command is meaningless. You've got to get the best people to work with you from any division. Call it horizontal. Ask your boss, and the boss would be who? Probably the Secretary of Defense or head of Navy, Secretary of Navy, probably. Coast Guard, I don't know what they're worried. But he knew that that wasn't going to work. And either the recent BP oil spill, where again he was called into duty there, and in both cases had the sense, in both cases, these are people who understood context, worry. And I wanted to slip this in as an important aspect of leadership, because unless you have that, my favorite leadership author is Shakespeare. Any of his history plays are magnificent. And Henry IV, Part 1, if you could read one play of Shakespeare that says more about leadership than any book that's available today, would be Henry IV, Part 1. And it was so interesting, if I may just say, just develop this a bit more.
Can you hear?
Henry's Prince Hal. Henry IV had his doubts about the kid. He didn't think, he famously said, this is the play, he didn't think that Hal was kingly enough. So he decided he better send what I call the first executive coach, someone named Falstaff, to go and be with, maybe talk sense to the kid. Isn't that interesting? Sends this avuncular figure, Falstaff. And Falstaff says remarkably, if you want to lead people, you've got to enter their world. And remember the scene where he takes off the royal robes and puts on the sort of enlisted man's fighting, and he goes and joins anonymously and listens to what the troops are saying. Contextual, not just emotional intelligence, it's knowing the territory. Remember that musical, the music man, you gotta know the territory? I remember the disastrous campaign of Kerry in 2004, and he was the pickpocket of all response is, sailing. Okay, I'm not making this up. The second, the follow-up question is ridiculous, was, who is your favorite athlete? Now, at that time, Lance Armstrong had just won the Tour de France. How does Kerry answer this setup question? He says, he mentions the German who was number two that year. Now, what? I mean, I'm serious about that. He mentions this German name that no one ever heard of, not clearly the one that people in Pittsburgh would know. That's what I mean by when Falstaff talked to Prince Hal, it was on the, like that, and that was, you know, how many centuries ago was this coming? I think I left with your question, maybe.
I'll bring you back to the question, because I want to follow up on your comment about leaders having to do the right thing and telling the truth. And I'm trying to figure out, and you'll help us figure out, where is the relationship between telling the truth and leadership? And you imply, by doing the right thing, that leaders have a certain, or should have, a moral code. Because how else can you distinguish between what's right and what's wrong?
Yeah.
And I wonder, Warren, what is the source of morality today, in the context of morality today? I don't think it's the biblical text. I don't think it's the Ten Commandments. As we have moved away from theology as being the moral code, in other words, God asks us to do the following, and here is a ledger. These are the things that are the truth. These are the things that you ought to do. What relationships, you talk about context, what is the context for morality today, and how does it relate to the leadership?
Wonders whether you can afford the house, all of knowing full well as a leader that the move is the secret move for a lot of reasons. That may not be a good example, but it leads me into the following. I think this is not an escape from your issue, but I think it's plunging right into it. But a little bit indirectly, I think the first and primary task of the leader is to define reality. Sounds very vague, general. It is vague and general. But putting it differently, a leader's primary goal is to provide perspective and an understanding of the situation we're in. And the following is, you have to then say, here are the things we are going to do, specifics. Call them sound bites, but I don't want to trivialize it. But A, B, C, make it brief, short. This is how we are going to deal with this risky, difficult environment. In our present situation, to put it pretty close to home now, one of the best books I've read about the first year, at least, of President Obama is by a Newsweek author, Jonathan Alter. It's a good book. It's called The Promise. I think he's the only one. The book came out a little over a year ago. Obama was, without question, a very complex figure. Right now, I think our leadership in general, not just at the presidential level, I don't think I would trust any leader who cannot deal with complexity right now. I think it's key. And a colleague of mine is doing some research on this in a corporate area and is finding out that only about 5% of the 300 plus leaders he studied, according to all the kinds of tests he's used, have the cognitive complexity to deal with the situations they're facing. That's scary, isn't it? Well, think of it at the presidential level. And that's what I mentioned soundbite earlier. I was really talking about getting people with it in the visceral, not just in their minds. So I think you can be, I think it's terribly important to be realistic and not stupid about reality. When George W. would talk about, you know, we're winning the war and all that, on split screens you could see people being, that we weren't winning the war in Iraq. I mean, this is just, you know, I'm just not picking on George W., I'm just saying that you can, that it's terribly important for, the first step I said is define reality, provide perspective, maybe it's, you love the phrase. Second is, here is what we're going to do in this uncertain, turbulent, chaotic, I can labile context of our environment right now. These are the steps. And thirdly, to get people aligned behind us. Now those three things have to do with authenticity, because it's terribly important to be real or authentic in describing the situation we're in. And I think that's what great leaders do, great national leaders must do. I think this is what you know, if you look back at and I think, but also, Grace reminded me today of Roosevelt years. He was referred to as a happy warrior. You can provide perspective, which is not very, sometimes very pleasant, but you also, and I should have added this as the fourth thing, the second thing I mentioned is to what are the steps we're going to take to get there with some timelines that are realistic, you know, that are hard. You don't want to put yourself in a shadow saying, we're going to yell our troops home by X date. You know, that's going to be very careful about this. And then make sure that you get alignment if you can. And then all of this, the subtext is you have to actually create the sense in your followers that that you understand them, have the empathic reach to know what they are experiencing. And this is about the Hebrew idea of this, because the word that came to my mind Commission is sick, he is, in his resignation speech, he talked about you have to love your troops. You don't have to carry their weight and the lesson. You have to really love what you're doing in your people. I mean that, L-O-V-E. I mean, it's not the word you see in the leadership literature. But that definition you have, N-A-S-I, I will never forget. It's beautiful. So, do you want to paint a picture so bleak, and it may look bleak, that you might as well give up and resign? If you're a leader, I think there's a certain mistake. And most leaders I've interviewed, and over the 60 years I've been observing, researching, writing about leaders, I must have interviewed maybe close to, I don't know how many, but I would guess close to 700, 800, I don't know, maybe less. I may be off, plus or minus 100, I don't know. But I'll tell you, almost all of them, all of the assembly boards, generally had an upbeat, generally optimistic. And again, to use a current example, a person I truly want to succeed and I admire enormously. I listened carefully to the speech President Obama gave on Wednesday morning, where he dutifully took responsibility. But I didn't see in him that audacity. Remember that book he wrote? The audacity was in the title. I didn't, and yes, last night we looked, on Sunday night, I made sure to look at him on 60 Minutes. And I rarely feel this way, but I felt he wasn't, I think the empathy was there, touching. I think some recognition. But I didn't get that sense of here's what we must do as a nation. And yes, we have to have alignment, and yes, we have to. But at a certain point, here are my grapples. He doesn't have to disrespect the people who voted for him in 08, but did 2 years later. He has to be very careful about that. But at the same time, the thing I found lacking, if I may, because it's an example where I'm using Mr. Obama just as an example, but at least my experience, but we all have probably seen him on TV. And what I was hoping for was more of a sense of, yes, I'm going to do my best for this recalcitrant Congress, but there's a point. Here are the things I will stand for and fight for. He doesn't have to say I can veto it. He has that in his pocket. But he doesn't have to say that. But to say, I'm going to do everything I can to make this a bipartisan thing. But at certain points, leaders have to. Now, that's escape, a little bit different from the question you asked, which is about authenticity. But I think that indirectly.
You have. And you spoke about recognition of reality, and I want to address a new reality and wonder how leaders are going to be dealing with it. And I think that's communications and technology. Your book traces the journey of leaders primarily through the 20th century, when media play a very different role than it does today. You talk about FDR and his fireside chats on the radio and how he connected intimately with most Americans. And throughout the book, you give examples, you share examples of leaders crafting their own stories. Now, with the numerous television stations that are offered to us today, blogs, social networking sites, is it possible for a leader to control his or her narrative today? How does this change in technology and communication help or hinder leaders?
writes it as a terrific and difficult question, because you're quite right. When you think of, it was really Howard Dean, people may forget this, who was able to hire a guy named Joe Trippi, who started using the internet to collect funds. And Obama used that to his advantage in a way, and throughout the nomination race, the first six others, and then it came just from between Mrs. Clinton and Mr. Obama. And certainly the internet was very important in raising money. I think the very question brings forth the significance of getting that story, that narrative, and that perspective, cutting through the voluminous amount of different sources of information today. But I think people are hungry for some sense of that, where you know, this is something that I think is a correct, good understanding of where we are right now. I think that, you know, I don't want to over.
Any longer to this diatribe that gave us every reason to lose faith in leadership. And we are an optimistic people. The Hebrew text talks about a people as being imprisoned by hope. Hope is always within us.
Imprisoned
by hope. And I think we are imprisoned by hope. But the hope has to have a sense of culture, a sense of courage, a moral core, so that morality is not always situational.
Right. Let me just say one more thing. The thing you're just, I just was sensing you were opening up to the audience. Great. It's really good. When some months ago, Corey, you were visiting me in the hospital, and you told me something from the scriptures which stuck with me. And it was something like,
know before whom you stand. Always know before whom you stand, which is your point about know the people in the street. Know them. Know before whom you speak. Know with whom you are keeping company. Know the people that you plan to lead. So, I'm not the one being interviewed. I want to remind myself. And I'd like to ask one final question. Give you and the audience an opportunity to ask some questions. I'd ask if you were surprised at all by any of the questions.
I was just thinking we have two different scriptures, you and me. Mine is Shakespeare and yours is the Bible. And they're both pretty damn good when you put them together.
Okay. Do you think any leaders have read Shakespeare or the Bible? Incidentally, I am not down on leadership. In fact, I am so hopeful that a leader will arise who will tell the truth, deal with reality, and say, this is what I believe we must do. I would feel somewhat confident that we have an opportunity to do what we need to do, and I really do feel that. And having come from Africa, and having met some people who guided us and drove the Jeep to be born to a truly future nation. They were truly future.
Why you said what?
I think they were appropriately argumentative. I really appreciated everything that was said was challenged from their perspective. And they made me see that I brought certain Western eyes to Africa. And they made me aware. And I'm so grateful. I wasn't an American who came with a message and they were interested. They were most interested in learning of our experience and how to apply it. And I guess I must admit that I was encouraged by the animal kingdom where there is no genocide. I was encouraged by the fact that animals have prey to satisfy them. I learned a great deal, and I learned their appreciation of the animal. Which lead me to the last question, which is there a question you wish I had asked that I didn't?
myself at that, because I was thinking, well, you know, what's the price of your book, Dr. Bennett?
No,
I think that you're...
Okay, speaking of the price of his books, Warren will be here to sign. We have a lot of books out there awaiting his inscription.
It's about time.
It's all about time. It's all about time. It's really a magnificent insight. And that's why I had a problem with the subtitle. I find it to be a magnificent insight into the life of a very remarkable human being. Worth reading and worth reflecting. Okay.
Well, one thing I want to just ask you, Lori, after you hear from the audience, I'd like to read just a paragraph of my poem I received from my son, the youngest of my three, writing from Prague, where he is living with two youngsters and his Czech wife.
I'd like you to read that note, which is in the book.
No, I'd like to have a question.
Okay. Please. Okay, you want to take the question?
So, yeah, I'll repeat the question so everyone can hear. So.
Can you comment on leadership on Wall Street today, given the leader turned into a loser? I think probably in 2005 there could have been six leaders of Wall Street firms up there, from Lehman Brothers to Merrill Lynch to Bear Stearns. They would have been considered leaders in 2005, and today potentially could they be considered losers? Or how does leadership change over time as financial circumstances change?
So the question was about leadership on Wall Street in particular, and can leaders change from leaders to losers and maybe even back again to leaders?
To losers to?
To leaders again or to something else?
Yeah, boy. You know, I'm so old. Could you tell me your name and what you do?
My name is Ed, and I work in a software company.
Okay, thank you. That's a marvelous question, too. You know, I think question is marvelous about leadership because we really don't know a hell of a lot. It is such a, you know, what I would call to be fancy, a portmanteau of word. It has so many different connotations that it makes it, so every question is kind of interesting. Look, on a survey of confidence in leadership across different institutions, and I can start this with a national sample in 2005. So, and in institutions like medicine, education, media, financial sector, and so on. And from 2005 to 2009, the Wall Street, confidence in the Wall Street has just gone seriously downhill. So this is a culture that has helped breed a certain kind of behavior that makes it okay to give bonuses to people who are literally falling in love with. Now, I'm not interested in making a diatribe about, you know, the Wall Street. I'm interested in getting truth out. And I haven't yet seen the movie Inside Job, but the minute I can get time to do it, I'm going to see it. Because from what I hear about the movie Inside Job, which is about, it's a documentary, right? I don't know if you've seen it or not. But we're dealing with culprits who have still not yet, in my view, been brought to justice. People have been literally frauded by being given information which the company was saying, not just talk about subprime mortgages, but that's a beautiful example, who knew the shakiness of some of the things they were, not shakiness, but knew, in fact, that they were giving high credibility to stuff that they knew wasn't the truth, that they knew it wasn't truthful, what they were saying. So the only way I can really answer your question without sounding glib, or I don't have a good answer, except I'll tell you, that culture, it's got to be changed before we can
expect any change in the leadership. It is, I'm talking now not about personal, I mean, there are some people, I don't, who are just by nature psychopaths. They just find it easy to lie. Not, and there are people who are always being on the other end, but so much depends on the culture of a particular sector of our economy. Now think about this. In the years, 3 years leading up to the, quote, Great Recession, one-third of all corporate profits went to the financial sector, mainly Wall Street. One-third of all the corporate profits. Now, that's huge. And that culture was doing it, right? And when one of the deposed leaders said, well, you know, if I didn't pay my bonus, you would go to the other company. You know what I'm talking about, I think. Well, that, I think in a way, even though I do believe a lot in personalities and all that, but I think when it comes to authenticity, to being able to define reality with perspective and honesty, I think it relates a heck of a lot to the culture. I can't really answer specifically, will these people who were involved in this group, and they lost and are coming back, will they be different? Not unless the culture has changed.
Okay, you've got lots of questions.
Hi, Dr. Bennis. My name is Mike Singer. And I had a question for you. I know that you have taught...
You should introduce yourself more fully, Mike.
Okay, well, I was actually Warren's first student at USC. I was very...
30 years ago.
I don't know if I can get into that course. I'd like to.
My name is Tom James, and I have two questions. I was happy that you made the distinction between your frame of reference of Shakespeare and your biblical frame of reference. But what's some of your ideas on leadership and spirituality? And also the second question about global leadership and leadership toward the future. What are some components that need to be developed to accomplish that?
For those who didn't hear, the question was about both leadership and spirituality. Thoughts about global leadership for the future.
Yeah. We should have started with the audience asking the question.
I'm glad we didn't. No, that's such a good question, honestly, and I like all of it. But I struggle with that question a lot, just to begin with. I want to make this short. I struggle with it. And I struggle with the idea of God, and I have only very recently, I think I've come to a bit more understanding of me and spirituality. If you read my work, I think you'd say this is a spiritual guy. You know, is he God-fearing? Well, that is not clear in my work, I don't think. But I realize that. Even though I can't give you, I just know that there exists something that, all I can tell you is this, let me put it simply, as I can put it, but you can see, I hope you can sense me struggling with your question, and it is, a struggle between reason, being an academic, and revelation, both. And I think recently I've come to a better understanding of everything. I think if I look back on what I've done with my life, what could be more noble than education? And when I think about what I've worked on primarily is making human institutions, it relates to the question about Wall Street, making human institutions cultures of learning and growth. And yes, you got to make money. Yes, there's a bottom line. You can't be foolish about those things, right? But yet, the best thing is keep at least those two big things in mind. The lightening load of the weight of the people that currently are leading. So, in a way, I think whether or not I know it or not, I think my work, my life, has been in the direction of working for human betterment, to use an old-fashioned word. That's the best way I can put it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, this is Rosa Carrillo. Is there a different mental model for both the women leaders than there is for both the men?
The question was, is there a different model for mentoring women leaders than male leaders?
You know, I thought a great deal about that question over the years. As a university president in the 70s, at the beginning, sort of affirmative action. Thought about it. And I think these days, well, we're still so far, as just as we are with, if you look at just corporate boards, I am just really unhappy at the small percentage of women on corporate, on, say, the Fortune 200. In fact, when I did my study on leaders that I mentioned before, there were only two women. And one was an owner who was on the board. Two women out of the 500 Fortune companies. Two. I mean, that glacier is slowly melting. That glass ceiling, what a break. All that. However, 10 years ago, I said to, if I were mentoring a woman, this was when I said, my sense about women is that they have to be more paranoid. That sounds weird, doesn't it? They have to really be aware of the politics of the context in which they're involved in. And, you know, and all those studies on brain mapping and all that indicate that under stress, women tend, and men under stress under these studies, fight. So I think it'd be important for women to understand the politics, and I mean this in the best sense of the word politics,
in connecting. And that's been more difficult for women because they don't go to the same locker room. You know, they don't play golf. They play, you know, all those things that bring guys together. You know. So I think it's changing. Basically, I think my sense is this. But I've said this too long to feel comfortable with it, but I really still believe it. That given the percentage of, quote, knowledge workers, that is, people who are educated and who believe in social justice, that women, given their early socialization, are more and more, I think, equipped to deal with the organizations of the future that I think are coming around. But it is a slow process. Down deep, I don't think I would differ. And if I were the criteria I used earlier, you know, about defining reality, the specific steps to get there and to align people, I don't think that would be different before talking to an all-woman audience, as I occasionally do. But I think we still are so far behind in so many subtle ways how we bring up women versus how we bring up boys and girls. It's still deeply textured, and it's going to take some doing. But basically, I don't want to think that what I have written or said or believe about leadership doesn't apply. But with the exception of the socialization process, we've got still a long way to go, as we do equally in the race area and the ethnic area as well. I'm not only sanguine that we've made the progress we must make for our own good and our own self, our collective self-interest.
I want to just sidebar to you your question. I personally, as a man, wish that I had been mentored by many more women than I had. The struggle of women who guide this culture, the understanding and perspective that women bring, and I must tell you that I missed my children, perhaps, or my grandchildren. The mentoring by women of men is crucial for civility.
I met with your top team months ago.
My leadership, forgive me. The leadership consists of 70% of women, and as far as I'm concerned, they could.
So, just time for two more questions. The gentleman in the black and gray.
Hi, Ken here. As a society, do we deserve the leaders we get, and how can we foster an environment to get the leaders that we deserve?
The question I'd most like to have asked, as a society, do we deserve the leaders we get, and how can we, as a culture, develop better leaders?
It's up to us individually, isn't it? I mean, it's up to us. We leaders are social architects of the culture, whether they like it or not. They are creating cultures which bring out from people, as Lincoln put it in his second inaugural speech, are better angels. The best leaders I know do bring out our better selves. And we have to model that. Everybody here who is leading, who wants to lead, or aspires to lead. You know, the marvelous thing, as I observed the hands here on the right, is the fascination and the importance of the topic. And it may sound like, I think, just to repeat myself, I I think of how one of the things I tell my students in the class I teach with Dr. Snapple, and it sounds strange, I said, but stalk mentors. Be careful who you, but mentoring is a dance. You know, someone just doesn't come along and think, oh, there's this Warren Bennis, isn't he fine? I'm going to tap him as my mentee. It doesn't work like that. You've got to be assertive. You've got to stay strong to sort of emphasize my point. Because then I worry of how many people I was lucky enough. Well, lucky enough, no. Well, I sought to be my mentors. I made myself, they're indispensable assistants. I carried their briefcase. But I wasn't just sucking up. I made, and the students who work with me, boy, this is this one quick example a couple of years ago. Terrific. He made himself indispensable. He made sure he picked me up when I got there in the morning. I told him I was, Grace and I just got back from Paris and heard this really interesting group at a hotel there, kind of a fusion group. He got me the album. It's sensing to me. So recruiting, and there's a dance. I've been picking the right people without becoming their clones.
I think we need to bring it to an end, and Dr. Bennis will be with us. I'm going to have a comment, and I know that you want to read, and I think it's an important letter that your son, your youngest son, Will, writes to you. And I also want to make sure, since I have to work here tomorrow morning, that I get myself out of trouble right now. I think the best situation in the world for the skirball or for our civility is the collaboration of the best of men and the best of women. Thank you.
And there, so I think we've got So in the cliche continuous learning, you know, it doesn't mean for people have got to realize that if they want to lead anything, well, live, forget about leading.
So why only you just hear that background?
the reviews you've received, writes Will, my son, have been good, but in my opinion, they don't do it justice. Now this is from a kid who's very straightforward and very critical, very stingy with his praise, but they don't do it justice. So many reviewers, it seems to me, are looking at this for one of your standard books where you call Lessons of Leadership to nice lists of aphorisms. And I think they're missing the beautiful memoir and case study that this book provides. I think you almost need people to read the book who are completely unfamiliar with your list of books and without expectations, to appreciate it. Anyway, I'm really writing because the book just made me cry, which is no small feat. With a line about Gunnar, your messenger, your runner, dying. I was actually half expecting Gunnar to die, but thought that nonfiction isn't so predictable. When you first said he was responsible for your choosing Antioch, I suppose I probably read or heard and forgotten about him dying somewhere else, but you had such wise patience in waiting to tell the reader until the expectation had passed and it seemed the war was long over. So I was retelling Leia, that's his name of his wife, I was retelling Leia about the narrative, and I started to cry. And just retelling the story brought tears to my eyes again. Anyway, I know it's so early in the book, but it is really wonderful to read so far. You're proud and loving son, Will. That's
I'd just like to remind everyone again that there are